From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Even before we knew that disease was caused by invisible germs that traveled in dirty water in the midst of a sneeze or the grip of a handshake, we knew that quarantining the sick was a key way to stop typhus, cholera, bubonic plague, polio, Spanish flu, and more. Now quarantines are here again. Big mistake, say the medical professionals. This hour on Point, quarantines then and now. Joining me first from Washington is Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, welcome back to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thank you so much.
So the CDC has just come out with new guidelines regarding Ebola in this country. Tell us what they are.
So yesterday evening, CDC announced a tiered system for classifying people at potential risk of Ebola who are coming to the United States from West Africa, and set out a series of recommendations for how each of these classes of returning travelers should be treated, ranging from the highest tier, the highest risk level, which would be healthcare workers who were working very closely with infected people in West Africa, may have had a needle stick, may have been exposed to bodily fluids directly on their skin. These people would be subject to a series of recommended restrictions on their travel and a very active monitoring regime, all the way down to a low risk traveler, who had no contact with anybody with Ebola or with anybody with symptoms.
Any recommendations about quarantine, Noam?
Well, so I think it's important as we have this discussion to sort of understand kind of what the quarantine kind of means, because I think it has taken on different meanings for different politicians and different regulatory agencies.
Yes.
What the CDC is talking about for the highest risk people is restrictions placed on public activities and restrictions on travel. It's also important to note that the CDC is recommending that people who fit into this highest level of risk must have a medical examination initially to make sure they don't actually have Ebola, and that they should remain isolated in a hospital. And that's the sort of strictest form of quote-unquote quarantining. It's called isolation, which is the medical term for it. But if they are not, even if they're determined not to have Ebola at the moment that they are tested, they still may be subject to restrictions and be told to stay at home. But that's a different kind of quarantine, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. than sort of what we saw with this nurse in New Jersey over the weekend, for example, who was placed in a medical setting in a strict isolation.
So let's talk about that for a minute. Here is the nurse who was placed under mandatory quarantine after she arrived at Newark International Airport from a month spent caring for Ebola victims in Sierra Leone. She told CNN's State of the Union on Sunday that her treatment was inhumane.
I just came back from one of the most difficult months of my life, and I am completely sympathetic. And no one knows, no one can predict if I will develop Ebola or not in the next 21 days. And most aid workers come back will not develop Ebola. So to quarantine everyone in case, you know, when you cannot predict who may develop Ebola or not, and to make me stay for 21 days, to not be with my family, to put me through this emotional and physical stress is completely unacceptable.
And here are the politicians. On Fox News Sunday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie defended his decision to place anyone who may have been exposed to Ebola under mandatory quarantine, even if they do not show symptoms.
It's in their interest and in the public health interest to have a 21-day period thereafter if they've been directly exposed to people with the virus. And as we saw with what happened with some of the healthcare workers in Texas, with the CDC shifting protocols, we had people who were infected from that type of contact. And we just can't have that in the New York, New Jersey area. And that's why Governor Cuomo and I agree on this. And now you see that they agree in Chicago as well. I think this is a policy that will become a national policy sooner rather than later.
And here's New York Governor Cuomo defending a mandatory 3-week quarantine for healthcare workers who've had contact with Ebola patients, but announced that the policy will no longer force them into isolation at hospitals.
From an operational efficiency point of view, and from a safety point of view, the preferred option is to ask them to stay at home. The healthcare worker will come to their house twice a day. They can have their family, whoever is normally there. It's not that they're stopping their life. But if they become symptomatic, you will have limited the number of people they will have been in contact with.
So, Noam Levy, these governors, Cuomo and Christie, have shifted their positions slightly on this matter under pressure?
It appears so. Governor Christie obviously finally allowed the nurse to return home to Maine, where she's going to remain, at her home, rather than in a far more isolated medical setting. But I think it's important to understand that the governors still seem to be requiring greater restrictions on people who have been in West Africa than the CDC is recommending, which is their prerogative under law and under the traditional division of public health responsibilities in the U.S.
Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Dr. Howard Markell. He is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School, a professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases, and of health policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He's also the author of two books on the history of plagues and how societies have responded to them, Quarantine and When Germs Travel. Dr. Markell, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
So give us a historical perspective here. We've heard from Noam Levy about sort of the latest today. Put this into perspective for us as far as history is concerned and quarantines. When was the first documented quarantine?
Well, that's really hard to say in terms of when people started isolating the infectious. You can find evidence of this in antiquity as well as in the Old Testament. But the word quarantine really emerges in Middle Ages, particularly in the port of Venice, which was then the largest port in the world. And it comes from the Italian word quaranta, or quaranta giorno, 40 days. And that was the Venetians' response to the Black Plague of the 1370s. And they elected to stop all ships from coming into port for a period of 40 days. Now, why 40 days? Because that was probably the time they observed the plague to burn itself out, although some people feel that that comes from Hippocratic writings where you separate an acute or an infectious disease lasting about 40 days or less from a chronic disease which tends to last 40 days or more.
So typically who imposed quarantines and then how were they enforced?
Well, for many years, it was the state. It was the government. And there was always a mercantile or commerce aspect to it. No port really wanted to be heralded as the plague port because you couldn't bring goods and services and ships in or out. So typically, it was public health officers later in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century. But politicians or leaders tended to really have the control of the button.
And what was the public response generally to quarantines?
Well, it's funny because I've written these history books on this topic, and I feel as if I'm living my books all over again, only it's in the present. So the public has decried any time there has been an absolute use of quarantine. Those in quarantine have never given a positive view of it. And while it has changed from, say, the 19th century, because back then you would be put on a remote island and often put with people who are actively ill with the infectious disease, because don't forget, back in the 1890s or even in the early 1900s, there were no medications at all for somebody with an infectious disease, a serious disease, or a not-so-serious disease. And so the real emphasis was to protect the public at large, but you accepted the fact that the individual or individuals with the infectious disease were either going to battle it off with their own bodies or die of it. So there's always those types of complaints. Politicians have always butted head. There's always been internecine battles, particularly in the United States, between the federal health officers or the state or local officials. Businessmen have really not enjoyed quarantine because it harms their business, and on and on and on. There's always been a lot of people who have not been happy when a quarantine order has been made.
So as we look at the Ebola epidemic and the quarantines that are going on and the questioning of politicians and the politics associated with all of this, what do we learn now? What can we learn from the history of quarantines as it relates to what we're going through today?
Well, I think the most important lesson we can learn is ever since quarantine was first proposed, if we use that Venetian law, and some might use earlier laws, but ever since it was proposed, it has been changing. The term has been changing, and there's multiple meanings and definitions of quarantine depending on what era you're looking at. But relatively soon after the 40-day law in Venice, there was a 30-day law. What we have found over time is that quarantine and isolation rules have been fine-tuned, have been better used depending on the natural history of the microbe in question. So if you are isolating somebody with a terrible, deadly form of flu, that would be only a few days as opposed to Ebola, which we're talking about 21 days, because it has a lot to do with the incubation period of that microbe.
A lot to get to this hour. Thank you for being with us, Doctor. Stick here. We're talking about the history of quarantines and whether they will help us stop the spread of Ebola. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the fascinating history of quarantines this hour. My guest is Dr. Howard Markell, director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School, and the author of Quarantine and When Germs Travel. Great to have you with us, Doctor. Thank you again.
Thank you.
So historically, what's the balance between legal, medical, and the civil rights issues associated with the decision whether or not to quarantine?
Well, that's a terrific question. And there's always been this tug of war between the rights or privileges of the individual versus the rights of the public at large. And one of the first laws of public health dates back to the ancient Romans, where they said that the rights of the many outweigh the rights of the individual. And for a long time, probably until about World War II, when we had antibiotics, started developing antibiotics, and we started developing better vaccines, that seemed to reign. That was the concern of the individual who was ill was not nearly as great. And as we have developed more with, you know, civil rights and protests and lack of faith in government, that individual rights has actually taken on with a life of its own, and all for good reasons, I think. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, for most of human history, it was really about preventing that disease from spreading to the healthy population.
So characterize then through scale and or effectiveness of different quarantines throughout history, from Spanish flu to bubonic plague to polio and the rest.
That's interesting. It's very hard to measure how much it worked or didn't work. We did a very comprehensive study of the use of quarantine and isolation, as well as other what are called non-pharmaceutical interventions, school closures and gathering bans during the great 1918 flu pandemic. And it was very intriguing to note that those cities, we did about 43, we did exactly 43 cities in the United States, those cities that acted early because, you know, flu is very easily spread and very easily communicated to others. So you have to act early before it gets to the community at large, and used not only quarantine and isolation of patients who were ill, but also layered it with school closure and or public gathering bans, and do it for a long time. Because once you take down the gates, the flu will spread again. And those cities that did just that and did it well had a far lower number of cases and deaths than those cities that did. But, you know, you have to really match the right quarantine to the right microbe.
And what does that mean exactly?
Well, for example, HIV. When AIDS was first starting to be noticed in the early 1980s, there were a lot of calls for quarantine of those groups that were stricken with it. So I remember hearing as a doctor, young doctor, a lot of calls to quarantine gay men or intravenous drug users or even Haitians. And the reality is we know how that virus spreads. It spreads by very specific activities, sexual contact, the mingling of blood with one person with another, or sometimes it can come from maternal fetal transmission as a woman has a baby if she is HIV positive. But those are very specific behaviors that a quarantine wouldn't really do much for. And that's different than influenza, which is incredibly easy to transmit to another. But you would only do it for flu if it was as deadly as 1918. You would not do it, for example, in 2009 when it actually wasn't all that deadly at all because it's such a bazooka and you would probably use a BB gun. Now, with Ebola, it's very curious, particularly with Governor Christie's edict the other day, because there are so many easier ways than putting that nurse into a tent without a television and without showering facilities and so on that would have been a lot more humane, a lot more up-to-date, and a lot more acceptable to all.
Dr. Markel, let me introduce another voice into the conversation. Now, joining me here in the studio is Dr. Ashish Jha. He is practicing physician and director of Harvard University's Global Health Initiative. Doctor, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So you've heard what Dr. Markel has been talking about, the history of quarantines. It's so interesting. As we look at the Ebola epidemic and what happened over the weekend with the different quarantines and then backpedaling a little bit on those quarantines, do you see politics trumping science as we look at the quarantine policies that are forming right now?
Yeah. So what we saw, I think, over the weekend was fear, and fear really trumping science, and political leaders who in some ways capitalize on that fear. And the fear makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, this is a new disease. We're still learning a lot about it. But it is not like we know nothing about Ebola. We've actually – it's been around for about 35, 40 years. There's a lot of science behind it. And it's pretty clear now that the governors did not consult with public health officials, did not consult with scientists. And in some ways, I think they gave in to the fear. And while that's understandable, it's also unfortunate. You'd think policies ought to be based a little bit more on the science. Mm.
Dr. Markel, respond to that, because what is the challenge of fighting the actual epidemic historically? And to Dr. Shah's point, the fear of one.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Unfortunately, the history shows that this is exactly what happens over and over and over again, that the political ramifications, the social ramifications often trump the scientific ones, often to the detriment of fighting that epidemic. And so I hate that line, you know, those who ignore the past are destined to repeat it. But when it comes to the history of quarantine, it sure seems that way.
Let's get a call in here from South Meridian, Connecticut. Art is on the line. Hi, Art. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
First, I want to say thanks, Jane. You, Tom Ashbrook, you got a great program. My comment is about the young lady. That, I mean, she's a heroic young lady. Stepped down there to
the nurse, Casey Hickox. Yep.
Yes, I'd just like to say she came home, and we're all. I have no idea about the Ebola disease, but I do know that I don't want my family to be a part of that infection, and I'm sure that most of us don't want to be a part of it. I know that young lady understands the disease, but when she comes to this country, she should understand that we've got a protocol to try and protect us. And it may not seem fair, but it should in fact include the professionals like the doctor in New York who unfortunately came down with the disease and wasn't aware of it.
So you think this nurse should have stayed in quarantine, Art? I hear you. Let me get Dr. Shah's reaction to that.
Yeah, so, you know, I completely understand that logic, and it makes sense. But if you think on some level, but here's the issue. I don't actually care that much about the fairness issue myself. What I really care about is what is the best way to protect the American public. And the problem is that we know that until she develops symptoms, really severe symptoms, she can't spread it to somebody. It doesn't work that way. It's kind of like the fear during the early HIV days where people worried that if you shake someone's hand, you're going to get HIV. We knew that wasn't how you transmit the disease. It's the same thing with Ebola. You can't transmit it until somebody's pretty far along in their disease course. But there is a cost to quarantine, and that is that it makes it harder to fight the infection in West Africa, and that's what puts American families at risk.
Let's hear more about that. On Sunday, here's Dr. Anthony Fauci. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. He was talking on ABC's This Week and saying that a mandatory quarantine will have unintended consequences.
There are different levels of risk to a healthcare worker, and that there are different levels of monitoring. If you put everyone in one basket, even people who are clearly no threat, then we have the problem of the disincentive of people that we need. Let's not forget, the best way to stop this epidemic is to and protect America is to stop it in Africa. And you can really help stopping it in Africa if we have our people, our heroes, the healthcare workers, go there and help us to protect America. We can't lose sight of that.
So, Dr. Zhao, you say, you know, you see these healthcare workers who are going over there to help stop this epidemic, and they're going to say, oh, my gosh, well, maybe I'm not going to go if I have to sit in a tent behind a hospital for 3 weeks when I come home.
Yeah. So the harder we make it for these people, the less likely we're going to have people going there. I look at the Ebola epidemic in West Africa as a fire in the neighborhood. We all live in one global community now, and there is a house on fire 10 houses down. We've got to put that fire out, because as long as it continues to rage, our house is at risk. The entire neighborhood is going to burn down, and we do not want to make it harder for firefighters, doctors, and nurses to go put that fire out. That's the fundamental analogy that we have to understand. And my take is, look, I don't want somebody with Ebola walking around my neighborhood if they're sick and infectious. But while they're asymptomatic, I would be happy to go bowling with them. I'd be happy to take a subway ride with them, because I know I can't get sick that way.
But what about the people who may not be so concerned about self-monitoring, you know?
Right.
That is an issue. And you hear caller Art talking about, ooh, a little nervous.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the CDC has put out new guidelines as of last night, which I like a lot. It's pretty aggressive, which says, you know, if you are a healthcare worker and you were there and you were exposed, we're going to do directive active monitoring. You're not just going to say, hey, call in if you get sick. We're going to check in on you. We're going to check your temperature. We're going to do it every single day. That is a pretty good compromise between quarantine and just saying we'll do it on the honor system. This is, I think, a very reasonable middle ground that most healthcare workers would probably be pretty satisfied with.
Let's go to Lakewood, Ohio. Gabrielle is on the line. Hi, Gabrielle. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question is to Dr. Martel from University of Michigan. I am a medical doctor, but not a virologist. We know that viruses have this proclivity of mutating. So something that we know now might not be something we know in the future because of the mutation. We know that, for instance, AIDS could be positive, but there's another strain of AIDS that might not be showing, and it might take a while for the second type of AIDS to show up. So just because your screening of AIDS right now is negative doesn't mean that you don't have another variety that's still harboring. I think that, yes, the Romans were correct. The discomfort of the few for the protection of the majority is absolutely paramount. And if somebody is not symptomatic now, does not mean it's not going to be, especially these healthcare staff, taking care of patients, and suddenly she starts having a little bit of symptoms, and then she has contaminated the whole floor. Mm. So this is a very serious concern.
Gabrielle, thank you. Dr. Gabrielle, glad you called. Dr. Markell, respond, please.
Well, certainly the mutation of viruses is a concern. But if you look at the biology of such mutations, is they don't turn on a dime. And I don't think we're in danger of that happening in the immediate future. That said, the CDC and other groups around the world are monitoring this virus very closely with good surveillance to check and see if that does or does not happen. So you need to have a very good surveillance system. And one of the great things about living in the 21st century, and especially since the threat of bird flu and the 2009 influenza pandemic, the federal government in the United States through the CDC and many other groups around the world, including the WHO, have set up surveillance labs around the world, including in West African nations, to make sure that is very closely monitored. It's a concern, but I think the bigger concern is very much what Dr. Shah just said about putting out that fire. You know, it's not just a global village. There's no boundaries. There's no borders anymore. So an outbreak
anywhere. It can go everywhere, and we need to think about that very closely. And that's where we really need to put a lot of our efforts, is putting out that fire in West Africa right now.
Dr. Sah, speak to that. No boundaries, no borders. I mean, we're in a different era. It's a different time.
It is a different time. And you know, there's been a lot of speculation about why is this Ebola outbreak so different from all the others. There have been quite a few. Every few years, you see one or two pop up. And this one is meaningfully different because the travel patterns, urbanization in Africa, it has spread much more quickly. And my sense is that this is the new normal. We're going to see a lot more of these kinds of outbreaks, where an outbreak in a rural region reaches the city much faster and gets global much faster. And, you know, I often say if we want our iPhones built in China, we're going to have to deal with viruses built in Liberia and Guinea. That's the reality of living in the 21st century. And so we need a strategy that deals with that. And the strategy is we have got to go to West Africa. We've got to put the resources, the people, and get the virus under control for our sake, if not for the sake of the people in West Africa.
Let's go to Chicago. Gil is on the line. Hi, Gil. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Hey, so my question is, I actually am a nurse as well. I am an emergency room nurse. I have experienced over the last week, every 12 hours or so, a change in protocol and scrambling for personal protective equipment protocol to be in place. The CDC had indicated there was a breach in protocol by the nurses earlier on. I have come to a realization that as a frontline hospital worker, that we really are not prepared for such virulent viruses and so forth. So, if we can agree that quarantine contains people in fixed spaces, the hospital being a fixed space and the people within the hospital being fixed spaces themselves, we have really not been prepared for the breaches in the other states of being. In other words, if somebody lands in the airport, shows up at the hospital with asymptomatic symptoms or lack of symptoms, but has a great story about being in Sierra Leone, being a peace care healthcare worker or a Peace Corps worker, we are not really prepared to contain the virus potential virus. At that point in time.
Got it. So you need more better training to deal with these patients. Gil, thank you so much for calling. You know, it's true. It seems these quarantine rules and protocols are changing almost daily, depending on geography and political climate. Some states have different guidelines altogether. How is this playing out across the country, Dr. Zah?
You know, it's interesting, thinking back to the summer when the disease was really taking off in West Africa, I saw the CDC put out its guidelines about what hospitals in the U.S. should do if an Ebola patient landed here. My sense is most hospitals didn't take it seriously. People have not done what they really need to do. We're learning as we go along, and that is the challenge in this disease.
We're discussing quarantines through history and now. Today, in a world frightened by the fever and Ebola spreading in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break and your calls. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Ebola and efforts to stop it at its source and to stop it here in the United States by any means necessary. My guests are Dr. Howard Markell, a medical historian and pediatrician at the University of Michigan Medical Center, Medical School, and the author of Quarantine and When Germs Travel, and Dr. Ashish Zah, a practicing physician and director of Harvard University's Global Health Initiative. Here's some sound from Sunday on CNN's State of the Union. House Oversight Chair Republican Representative Daryl Issa of California said that without a consistent national Ebola response system, people are turning to their state leaders for protection.
Governors of both parties are reacting because there isn't a trust in the leadership of this administration. Getting that back is doable. It's our responsibility to do it, but it's also our responsibility now to second guess at our level the things that are said to us to make sure the American people do have watchdogs.
Dr. Zhang, what has been the effectiveness to your mind of the communication about Ebola, about measures of protection, about quarantines? How effective has that been from the CDC?
I think the CDC itself would admit that they have not done as good of a job on communicating what we know, how to manage this, as well as they could have. I mean, here's the bottom line. I think Tom Frieden, who is a phenomenal director of the CDC, very knowledgeable, very dedicated individual, basically came out and said, we know what to do. We know how to contain the disease. Hospitals across America are ready. And there was a gap between what we know. We do know how to contain this disease and our ability to execute on it. And I think that initial overconfidence in the ability of the Dallas Hospital to do this right, the ability of the health system to effectively manage this disease has made a lot of people lose faith. And it is important, I think, now to communicate what we know, what we don't know, where the challenges are, and we're going to learn as we go along. It's not like we've had a whole lot of Ebola outbreaks in the U.S. that we can go back to and say, boy, if we just did it the way that we did it last time, we're learning on this one.
Dr. Markell, do you agree? Is there a gap between what we know and our ability to execute on it?
Well, absolutely. And the idea that up until a few weeks ago we never had Ebola in the United States really speaks to that. And the most important issue is this, is that every epidemic is a learning curve. And while we can snipe at this comment or that comment that Dr. Frieden or others made, the reality is if you look at how the CDC and other agencies have been handling it, they get better every day. They're learning from miscues or missteps. They're plugging in leaks where they may have existed in protocols, and they're getting better every day. And that is something I don't think the American people understand or appreciate. You know,
I do think, though, Doctor, that I do think a lot of people have been confused. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, what about this leadership? I'm not quite understanding what we should do and the appropriate way forward.
Yeah, and there's no question that public communications is an essential part of public health. I mean, the first word in public health is public, and different people have different levels of education or understanding of very arcane medical issues, and that needs to be improved. But if you really look, for example, in Dallas, okay, so Thomas Duncan did come from Liberia. He came down with Ebola, and those two nurses unfortunately contracted it during the treatment, but then it stopped cold in Dallas. So the public health system worked. And we have the issue in New York City right now with Dr. Spencer, and our hearts and prayers go to him as well as to those two nurses. But again, we have not had other cases. The real story is what's going on in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, because it's spreading like wildfire there. So we can say he didn't say this correctly or he didn't say that correctly, and to be sure, the government needs to do a much better job of explaining it. But I don't think they're doing a bad job.
Get some more calls in here.
Means.
Louisville, Kentucky. James is on the line. Hi, James. Welcome.
Jane, doctor. I'm on my way to go give a lecture to a hospital as we speak. Doc, is it okay that I use your Venetian example? I thought that was fabulous. Is that okay, please?
I don't own it. Absolutely, it's in the public domain.
Okay. My point is, I know we're looking at the stopping in the West Africa, but the idea of quarantine then expands a little further. If our healthcare workers... Now, if we have an outbreak within the United States, a small one, shall we say, what do our healthcare workers then start to think? Am I going to be quarantined because I'm working with a patient at my facility? Even though we are fully encapsulating them in PPE and they are not symptomatic, I think we're opening up a large can of worms that maybe these entities are not really thinking about. I think it's a very dangerous situation with the idea of quarantine all healthcare workers.
James, thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Zhang?
Yeah, so if you think about what happened in New York, you know, Governor Cuomo was happy to quarantine the workers coming from West Africa, but did not actually suggest that he was going to quarantine the Bellevue workers who were taking care of Dr. Spencer. That's interesting, because if the risk is that any healthcare worker taking care of an Ebola patient ought to be quarantined, then we should be quarantining all those Bellevue workers, which, of course, would be completely silly, and Governor Cuomo knows that it's silly. So I think this is much more about playing to that perception and that fear. We need our healthcare workers to know we have their backs. We're not going to quarantine them unless there is a good clinical reason to do it. We're not going to be capricious in how we handle this.
Dr. Zhao, you were telling me earlier, I mean, you have serious concerns about the potential of Ebola spreading to places like Shanghai or Delhi, big, dense cities. Talk about going global and fast, right?
Yeah.
China is sending lots of doctors to Africa. They understand the potential economic threat if Ebola takes over there. I mean, talk about that. I mean, we can talk about patients coming in and quarantining them in Newark, but, you know, when people get the idea they can fly into Los Angeles or they can fly into Chicago or wherever, it's a totally different story.
Yeah. So, you know, what does make me nervous, what does keep me awake at night is the Ebola patient who shows up in Shanghai or New Delhi. These are countries that are obviously very crowded. Yes, they have health systems that are better than what's happening in West Africa, but they're not as good as ours. And if the disease begins to spread in India, China, or other places around the world, the challenge of containment becomes much, much harder. I think we have a golden opportunity right now, a narrow window of opportunity to still stamp this disease out in West Africa before it becomes global. And I don't want us to be distracted by issues around quarantining healthcare workers coming back into New York, because that's just not the point. We have to focus on the issue at hand.
Mary Jo is in Springfield, Ohio. Mary Jo, thanks for waiting and welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hey, listen, I have a couple of points. I am a physician in Springfield.
Okay.
Two things that both doctors that you have said. We don't have all the answers about Ebola, but the question is, how do we reassure the public and prevent panic when we don't have all the answers? Our two concerns, we have two groups of people that are an active infectious threat, those with active Ebola, whom we are quarantining. But then the second group are those who have been exposed to active Ebola, and that consists of the public and healthcare workers. Healthcare workers that take care of many Ebola patients are a different subset than those who are here in the United States taking care of one patient. I mean, the risk goes up with each patient. And the fact is, we truly don't have all the answers about how this virus behaves, as each of your experts has said. We're still collecting data. This is the new normal, is that international travel creates much more avenues for people to infect. But the other thing that we have to take into account is what Dr. Markle's talked about, and that is that human beings have self-interest since the beginning of time, and people will lie. In fact, Mr. Duncan lied the first time he came to the emergency room, which was one of the reasons he was missed. He did not admit to either because he didn't know or he was lying about his exposure. I do think, frankly, that it's appropriate to quarantine healthcare workers coming back from the front lines. This does not mean for 1 minute that I think we ought not to be sending them, but why in heaven's name would we not do a common sense, practical, cautionary thing? That doesn't mean in a tent with no TV and no shower. It means making it a paid part, at hazard pay, like the rest of it should be, a paid part of their deployment, considering a 3-week quarantine time on the back end in some wonderful place that America has a spot to put them, the Caribbean or somewhere. It's a 3-week paid vacation at the end of deployment. And it furthermore gives us a population to study who's got the highest exposure. I mean, right now, the entire world, every citizen is a member of an experiment, a living experiment, and there's no consent required.
Got it, Mary Jo. I'm gonna take us to another call here who has another question based on what you said. Tressa is in Austin, Texas. Tressa, welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have one quick comment. I wanted to thank you for all the thoughtful discussions about this. It's helped ease my fears in the last weeks, as well as my family's. Just knowledge is power, and it's helped a lot. I do have a question about the non-healthcare workers that also have the ability to travel from West Africa. What are the measures for those folks in that same sense when they come into the States? Are we also requiring an active monitoring period of 21 days, or what is the situation?
Right. What are the rules for the non-healthcare workers? We've been focusing a lot on the doctors and the nurses, Dr. Zhao.
Yeah, so CDC has guidelines on this, and the latest ones as of yesterday. And as Dr. Markle said, we're learning and we're evolving on these guidelines. But the ones that came out basically are based on risk. So what they do is you ask the person, where have you been? Have you been exposed to somebody who might have had Ebola? Were you wearing protective equipment? And based on that set of questions, you put them in a risk category. And if they're high risk, then You have a very active direct monitoring. And if they're low risk, look, I went there, but I didn't encounter anybody who had Ebola. I don't think I would. Then you don't have to have the direct active monitoring. You still ask them to check their temperatures for 3 weeks. So you have to do this based on risk. The way we actually practice medicine in any context, you sort of try to figure out is somebody high, medium, or low risk, and then you treat them accordingly.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's go to Aaron in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Aaron. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
Thank you. It's fascinating. Everything that's been said is very on point. Sometimes everybody's right in a situation. We have to learn from our history. Of course we do. But we have to do something new. I believe with all the things that are involved in this particular situation, and we have progressed as a society, as a world community, we have progressed to the point where everything is smaller now because everything is so accessible. So we have to act like we're in a new, whole new world. But still, some things are still the same. Fear in a crowd, because the public is different from a member of the public. A person is different from people. People are a lot less easily to control or to calm down than an individual person. So all of the things that we know from our history, the fact that this is a situation that started in Africa is going to be an issue for some people. They're going to think because it's in Africa, it's not going to be treated the same way. And so therefore their fears are going to be greater. Mm-hmm. So we have to try to create something new. I don't think not paying attention to the science is the right thing to do, but we also have to calm the people down by acknowledging their fears. So the lady Mary Jo from Springfield made a really good point. Why not just create a new type of isolation for the people who have been exposed to where it's not total?
I hear you. A new model of quarantine. It's an excellent point, Aaron. Thank you very much. I wanted to play this quick clip quickly here. We've been talking a lot about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He was striking back today at the CDC, insisting that he would end up on the right side of science and public opinion on this one. Here's NBC's Today Show's Matt Lauer.
Is it possible, well, Governor, you're on the wrong side of science here, but the right side of public opinion?
No, I'm going to be on the right side of both, ultimately, Matt. And I understand that the CDC has been behind on this. Folks got infected in Texas because they were behind. And we're not going to have folks being infected in New Jersey and other states in this country. Governors ultimately have the responsibility to protect the public health and the public safety of the people within their borders when folks come in with this problem.
We shall see how this plays out. Dr. Markell, I'm curious, has there been any sort of legislation growing out of public pandemics or quarantines throughout history in this country?
Well, yes. And Governor Christie touches upon an issue that makes managing an epidemic so difficult. You know, public health in this country has almost always been in the domain of the state or the city. It was a local phenomenon. And that dates back more than 150 or 170 years when the concept of infection was rooted to miasma theory, that somehow rotting organic garbage or dead animals or feces or what have you would give off emanations and pollute the atmosphere and cause an infection. But the health of, say, Newark would be very different than the health of New York City. But that has still remained on the books, and it has caused ambiguity and rivalries and battles between cities, states, and the federal government basically since the country has been founded. Now, in 1893, after a serious cholera pandemic in 1892, the federal government passed, the Congress passed the National Quarantine Act of 1893, which in the state of an emergency, a severe epidemic emergency, the President of the United States has the ability to add layers of quarantine or public health measures on top of what the state has done. But that has never been used because it would have to be a very, very serious epidemic. And we're not there with Ebola. But it does raise a very important question that you are alluding to. Isn't it time that we have come up with a rational, consistent and uniform plan from the federal government to the individual cities
of how to combat an epidemic when it comes to our shores.
Dr. Zaw, wrap us up here. I mean, how do you see this playing out as we try to manage Ebola, as we manage the efficacy and the medical necessity of quarantines?
Yeah, so I think, look, the scientific community has a responsibility to be clear about what we know and clear about what we don't know. We don't know all the pieces. That doesn't mean we don't know any of the pieces. We know some things pretty clearly about Ebola, right? Nobody in Dallas who was living with Mr. Duncan got infected. That is a very important point. The only people who did were nurses who took care of him at the end of his life. We actually know a lot. I think we have to be humble about what we don't know. And it is the job of public health officials and actually of the political officials to use science whenever possible, understanding its limitations. It is not perfect, but the alternative is to not use science at all. And that leaves us much worse off. And so we need a partnership between the political leaders and the scientific community where both sides show a little more humility.
What a very informative conversation this hour. Many thanks to my guests, Dr. Ashish Zha, director of Harvard's Global Health Initiative. Doctor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Howard Markell at the University of Michigan. Doctor, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Listeners, thank you so much for your comments. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.